Hey Wild Ducks. Welcome to our technology podcast. It's my pleasure to introduce the avatar of your host, Jerry Coleman.
Thank you, RJ. Welcome folks to the Wild Ducks podcast. Autocorrect. It's that invisible assistant you never asked for but can't live without. It fixes typos, saves time, and, let's be honest, sometimes leaves you scratching your head at a ducking. Odd replacement. But behind this everyday tech is a story of creative problem solving, bold innovation, and a relentless drive to make touchscreen typing possible. In part one of this two-part series, Jerry sits down with Ken Kashenda, the inventor of iPhone's autocorrect, to explore how this groundbreaking feature came to life. From early design challenges to unforgettable moments with Steve Jobs, Ken shares how big ideas become real, and how unintended consequences sometimes come with the territory. And with that,
I am thrilled to welcome Ken to the podcast. Welcome, Ken.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Let's get into this. So much to talk about. And I think our viewers and listeners are very curious and thrilled to hear about your time spent in iPhone development. And you've made some amazing innovations during that time. But I want to reflect on the sentiment that in your Wired magazine article titled "Sorry About That" and "You're Welcome." You know, if we can culminate in discussing what that means, because I, you know, with the dot 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 in my past, I certainly understand what that means. So let's start off, like, maybe a little bit on your history leading up to Apple, and then let's take it from there.
Well, right. So you know, that article that you referred to was about my work in inventing keyboard autocorrect for the first iPhone. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was some really, you know, interesting work and I think influential work that I did at Apple. But then you say, you know, there was a long road that took me to that point. Mm-hmm. I was maybe older than you might expect. I mean, I was 35 years old when I started at Apple.
Okay.
And I spent time before that as a fine art photographer. I lived in Japan and taught English. It took me a while to discover that technology and software development was really what I wanted to do with my career. And so there was sort of a long way around to starting at Apple. And I didn't start on the iPhone. I actually started on the Safari and WebKit project. My job from day one was the remit from Steve was, you know, just make us a web browser. So I did that for a number of years, and then got this wonderful opportunity to join the iPhone software development effort when it was very, very small, just a handful of people. There was so much work to do and so much innovative work to do to make
imagine.
That phone turn out the way that Steve envisioned it.
And Ken, this was Steve's second stint at Apple. This is
Indeed.
On his return, and then you kind of joined him. I'm sure everyone's curious. What was it like working with Steve? I mean, I see some, I can only tell what I see on TV and stuff, but sounds like sometimes he was a bit scary, or at least demanding. Maybe that's a better way of putting it. Can you share some of your experiences during those days?
So he was scary.
Oh, jeez.
he could be, but also very inspiring, I have to say. And what he was very, very good at was communicating a vision. Mm. And so, you know, there would be this top level vision coming from the CEO of the company. But then, then that vision was communicated down to people like me. I was an individual contributor. Mm-hmm. And I'll be honest to say that there were many, many people working on the iPhone who worked more closely with Steve than I did, for sure. You know, his time was very, very closely guarded, and he was very, very busy because he was not only working on the project that I was working on, but he was also running the rest of the company.
Yeah.
But what happened was there was this wonderful flow of work, this top-down guidance going down to individual contributors and then bringing that work forward to him so that he could see it and review it and comment on it in his very, very pointed, very, very specific way. And so, like I said, sometimes scary way, but also a very, always very constructive, you know, even, even when he was, you know, more animated than perhaps he could have been.
And Steve, I mean,
very,
Ken,
very clear.
Yeah, Ken, I imagine you were in the room with Steve when he, when you did playbacks and got to see his face and reactions. Did he show immediately? Like, how quick was he to kind of respond to an idea?
He was, it was instant, almost instinctive. He was able very, very quickly to see what he liked and what he didn't like in a piece of work, even when it was brand new to him, and to react in the moment. And that's actually something that he sought out in the people to bring him work and to comment on work, is that not only to be right, but to be right fast. And it's something that he fostered, is to you know, a very opinionated approach toward doing the work, make a choice, be decisive, and move on. Don't stay in one place for too long. Just make sure that you're always moving, hopefully moving ahead.
So Ken, what were the conditions like, and what was motivating your ultimate work on autocorrect? You know, were there, I know there was a breakthrough in a screen-based keyboard. There were things that were happening. So how did it come about?
Well, it was all about serving this design vision for the phone, which, I mean, it's kind of hard to think back now, but the most popular phones at the time we started working on the iPhone was the BlackBerry.
Right.
You can think of it as, you know, roughly, you know, the top half was a screen and the bottom half was a keyboard.
That's right.
And
yeah.
So Steve's vision was, well, what if you could make the whole thing a display?
Mm-hmm.
And so the keyboard had to appear in software when you needed it and then disappear when you didn't, when you were watching a video or playing a game or surfing the web or whatever it was. And so that was the design goal, was to make this keyboard in software. And there were going to be no physical buttons because it's a glass screen. And so, you begin going from there. And so there wasn't an initial idea that autocorrect was going to be the winning concept. It was a process of discovery. It's that it was so difficult to type that... that we discovered, and I discovered, that we were going to need software assistance in order to make the system viable, to make it work.
Right, right. And what was the most surprising or challenging aspect of developing the iPhone autocorrect feature? Like, and how did you overcome it? I can only imagine how many there were.
It wasn't always autocorrect. I went through a number of designs and we had these discussions about, well, if we could offer software assistance, that there would be a suggestion bar. And that wasn't on the first iPhone. It has subsequently come back so that there would be a bar above the keyboard that would show you, you know, give you suggestions, and that you would have to choose them in order to get the benefit of the corrected typing. And the decision was to give you what you meant rather than what you did, and to do that automatically. So if you fat fingered something or you typed certain characters and the software had a good idea that you meant something else, to just automatically change it out from you, because that's not the way that hardware keyboards work. Well, now they do.
Right, right.
But back then, it wasn't. Yeah. And so that was a kind of a psychological hurdle to get over.
I see. And Ken, was there an aspect of learning to this? I heard at one point that there was two dictionaries, and the first was a classic, and the second had more to do with some aspect of making things better. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, there were two dictionaries, but they were, one was a static dictionary, which was just all of the words in the English language, plus, you know, chat abbreviations and proper names. All of the Apple product names with the proper capitalization was in there. But all of those were in there. Everybody got those. And then there was a dynamic dictionary, which was based on the names in your contacts, the words, the special words or jargon that you type, whether it's in your field or if you just have, you know, some slang, maybe an inside joke, maybe you like to talk like a pirate, you know, so it would have an arg in your dictionary, right. Whatever. Right. You know, and so there would be this sort of double consultation going on of the static dictionary and the dynamic dictionary to decide what it is that you meant when you were typing.
Wow. All right, let's maybe step back a half a step or so. You wrote a wonderful book called Creative Selection, talking about creativity at Apple and the design process. So how did the culture under Steve shape your approach to innovation?
Oh, it absolutely did. I learned so much from being at Apple and seeing how big products can go, big ideas can just start as just, you know, a sketch on a whiteboard or a conversation in a hallway, or your very, very dynamic CEO making a pronouncement one day, we're going to do a new thing. Mm-hmm. And to go from that and to figure out all of the steps that you need to take that idea and make it real, I put down in my book, I called out seven characteristics: mm-hmm. inspiration, collaboration, craft, diligence, decisiveness, taste, and empathy. Were the seven ways that I tried to understand what it is that we did every day. You know, we all showed up like we did. You know, back then we were all showing up in an office every day. I had my own individual office with a door that I could close. I mean, it almost seems like ancient times now. But, you know, we did that. And we all came together and we collaborated and worked together on these ideas and tried to make products. And it was this process of trying to marshal all of these ideas and all of these efforts to try to make something real. And it was all really always based on progress. Steve always wanted to see progress. So that's what we did. We tried to make something concrete, some concrete progress every day using these sort of seven tenets that I described. And that was it.
Yeah, so Ken, you have a distinguished background in design. You also have a background in software architecture and engineering. I remember in the early days of software, the early days of the internet, the software engineer ruled. And their idea was a design idea. And then over time, I want to say Apple had a lot to do with it in the culture. The design way of thinking and with client centricity first started to roll. How do you see that balance evolving? The developer who has an idea, does anyone want it? Is it a good idea? Versus, the design thinking approach. Can you kind of
weigh in on that? The way that Steve characterized that at Apple was the intersection between liberal arts and technology. That's where Apple wanted to be at, was that intersection. And I think that's a good way of thinking about it. I think maybe another way that's even more personal is that the work is for somebody. I think that creative people and technical people, when they're making new things, it's very, very easy to become insular. To just think about, you're on your computer and there you are just writing lines of code. And it's very complicated. It's complicated to do that. It's also complicated to do design. But that in my work and when the work I've done has been successful, it's when you kind of pick your chin up and you look at that. Yes. Who is this for? And why would they want it? What is a person? Think about the work that you're doing from the perspective of someone who's never seen it before and is coming to it for the first time.
Yeah.
And how is that work going to explain itself to that person and convince them that there's something useful and meaningful in it for them.
Yes, yes, very nice. So Ken, let's talk about unintended consequences. I'm a child of that as well, so I can empathize. I saw a very informative and humorous YouTube from, I think it was, who was it? Wall Street Journal, I believe. And it was called Ducking Autocorrect. So can you talk about a little bit about some of the unintended consequences and how you dealt with it?
Yeah, so, you know, it is, you know, this idea that the keyboard prevents you from swearing is, it, you know, has kind of got out into the, you know, has, be, you know, has become a little bit of a meme, you know, damn you, autocorrect, you know, that sort of thing. But, you know, you think about it. You know, I can say that certainly for the keyboard while I was working on it, it would let you swear if you typed those swear words perfectly. If you didn't, the autocorrect was not going to help you swear.
Right.
It was not going to help you swear. Gotcha. So if you typed the those curse words perfectly, it was going to give them to you. And so, you know, the unintended consequences is that, you know, the software, you know, software is becoming sort of more, you know, more of a part of our lives all the time. And autocorrection is an example of that, where as we're communicating, we're now interacting with software that sometimes seems like it has its own idea about what you mean to say. And, you know, in a way, I think that it is unfortunate when software makes people feel like they don't understand what's going on with the machine and that they can't get it to do what they want.
Right.
And that's an unintended consequence. You know, you try to do something that benefits people. And I think a lot of times it does, but it also admittedly has this other effect of making things a little bit inscrutable, a little bit opaque. And to the extent that that happens, I'm sorry. And I think it's unfortunate. Hopefully, you know, computers are going to get easier and better to use as time goes on. And, you know, autocorrect was part of that effort, but you know, there's twin edge to that.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe with that, let's, if you can help leap into the future, maybe pull out your crystal ball and maybe share some of your thoughts about the next major leap in human device interaction.
Yeah, I think it's going to be AI,
okay,
for sure. I have been around the industry long enough that when I did my work 25 years ago on Safari, starting 25 years ago on Safari and WebKit, and I saw what the web could do to change the way that people interact with technology. Same with mobile. You know, the iPhone came along and I made my contribution to that, and it changes the way that it's changed the both of those. The web and mobile has changed the way that people interact with technology. And I just think that AI has the potential to do that, that and more.
Yes.
Because once you can talk to the computer,
that's it. Okay.
a lot of these problems that we're talking about human computer interaction are going to change. I think a lot of them are going to go away. And I am excited about AI and the potential for it as anything else I've ever seen in my career.
All right, Ken. Let's wrap up part one of this two-part interview, and let's save that thought for the next part. So, Ken, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts here, and I'm eager to continue this conversation.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Part one is a wrap. You've just heard how Ken Kishenda's journey led him to inventing iPhone's autocorrect, shaped by Apple's culture of innovation and Steve Jobs' decisive leadership. Be sure to tune in to part two, where Jerry and Ken explore trustworthy AI and the future of building more reliable fact-based technologies. Bye for now.